Thank you. Disconcerting to see so many friendly faces. I wish I actually had a curator's hat. I would like to have a curator's. I'm not quite sure what that would look like, but if I did have one, I would wear it today. It's interesting that a director's cut is generally a much longer version of the original film and generally puts in a whole lot of stuff that everybody else wishes they would leave out. This wasn't a process like that at all. In fact, I had a lot of stuff that I wanted to put in, as Leah will be able to attest, and gradually they were whittled away until we finally had just this final selection. And I think that's a good thing, by the way, not a bad thing. But the process was to find works that actually carried the narrative. There were a couple of works which unfortunately weren't available due to the condition and the need rewire and all of that sort of stuff. But the key ones that I wanted, fortunately, are all on the walls. When Chris first asked me about this idea, I thought, well, it's a terrific idea to go back and look at a collection over 20 years and how it's developed. Well, actually, the collection's developed over 50 years, but the gallery over 20 years. And I thought, well, why do we have galleries in universities? What is the point of having a gallery in a university? And how is it different from other public galleries or even private galleries? And I think there are some very, very key differences. One is a primary audience is students and staff and, of course, the general public. But students and the educational process is absolutely key to it. The other great resource you have working in a university is you have this enormous number of fantastically talented, incredibly intelligent, bright people with an area of specialization that they probably know more about than anybody else in the whole world. So you have this incredible resource that you can go to as partners to develop exhibitions. And the collection. The collections that grow out of university galleries are often very, very shaped around the particular interests of that institution. Now, Curtin has a very different collection from UWA, which is a very different collection from Edith Cowan, very different collection from Murdoch. Although there are some similarities and some artists appear in all of them, they do have a different focus. So I was trying to think of what would be one of the things that about the focus of the John Curtin Gallery collection or the University collection, John Curtin University collection, Curtin University collection, that would be worth really investigating. And as Sam just said, I came to this role as the Dean of Art and in charge of John Curtin Gallery from my previous role, which was head of the School of Art. So I was particularly interested in the educative process and the way in which the gallery and the art school could work together. And I was very keen to make sure that we made more of that or as much of that as we possibly could. So then I started thinking of looking at the collection and identifying as I was scanning through the pages and pages of the spreadsheet all the works that I remember being purchased from graduate shows. So that was students' work. And that led me to think, well, did we get it right? Did we always get it right? Did sometimes we get it wrong? Did we get it really wrong in some occasions and not include people that now everybody would be thinking, how the hell is it that you don't have a James Angus in your collection? So that all of it, I just thought, okay, well, that's definitely going to be the topic of my curatorial framework for this exhibition. I'm going to look at the works that were purchased from students in this institution. Because looking back on the collection, there are 484 works that are by West Australian artists. That's mainly in the painting and works on paper collection. Of that, at least a half, a little more than a half, in fact, are West Australian. And of that half, well, not of that half, but of the total 484, 147 are by people who had a direct relationship to this institution. So that's about a third. And I think that's actually really terrific, that about a third of the contemporary works in this collection are by graduates or staff of this institution. And long may that continue. I really hope that it's a very important part. And why is it important? Because looking back, you have this extraordinary archive. You can look back and see how the art school evolved, what were the key issues in contemporary practice at a particular time, which artists were doing really amazing things when they were students and then went on to do quite different, equally amazing things when they graduated and went out into the world. And I think particularly of the Christian de Vietri, and I was just so thrilled when I scanned through and I remembered this work by Christian. Christian was a student of mine, and I used to do a painting minor. It was one of the classes that I loved doing most of all. So I'd leave my dreadful office with all of the files and all the terrible phone calls and all the horrible, monstrous administration, and I'd go and spend the afternoon working with a group of fantastic students teaching painting. And one of the exercises that I set them was that we had to go out into the landscape and find art and make as little alteration to it as possible. Now, in my head, I thought, well, most people will go out and find, you know, a piece of wood or a panel, or they will find, and they will make a small addition to it. And that addition has to be absolutely perfect to make it their own, but not to change its character completely, but just to add a sense of ownership. So it was quite a nice project. And then all of a sudden, Christian comes in with this wonderful series of photographs, which he called On Safari. And what he did was he went out into the landscape with his camera and he discovered all of these animals in the landscape. So he discovered a giraffe, he discovered elephants, he discovered a walrus, zebra. That was perhaps a little bit too easy. And this one, I think, is a snake, isn't it, or a fossil. It was just such a beautiful idea. And I was delighted then when it was purchased at the degree show, because this was part of Christian's degree show in 2001. Now, when you look back on that, how many people know Christian de Vietri's work? Yeah, most people. Well, you know the big sort of thing, whatever it's called. Spander.
Yes, it's called.
Is that what it's called?
The Victorian King? Spander.
Yeah. Spander. Okay, Spander. The one at Elizabeth Quay. So that's Christian's work. And of course, he's gone on to do really quite remarkable things. He did his MA in the States, and he's actually in New York at the moment. So it's great to have a work that you can go back to and think, at this moment, in a young artist's development, this is where they were thinking, this is how they were operating, this is the sort of inventiveness with which they took hold of a project. And now when you look at his work, you go, yeah, I see it, I get it. I get how he has really come to this point. Would never have imagined it to be like this, but isn't it great that we have this sort of evidence? We keep working. Oh, well, we'll probably just walk around because I just thought, I'm just going to make connections if that's okay. And anyway, it'll be good for our legs. So this painting by Julie Dowling, for instance, is another example of a work which was bought from the degree show. So this was a work that Julie was doing in her studio when she was a student. And unlike Christian, in a sense, in that the work doesn't look very, very similar, if you look at this now, you can see where Julie really was coming from. I mean, Julie's work still uses overall pattern. She's still very interested in her own family, in representing her own family, the dignity of Aboriginal people, and combining it almost with almost like a religious motive, so that if you see quite a number of her works, she uses pattern almost like an icon, like a Christian icon, Orthodox icon. And you get that sense too of this flag, which is almost acting as a banner to identify her. I think it's her grandmother, I'm pretty sure. So there are some things in it you go, oh yeah, well, she's really improved in some areas, but you also get a sense that she was very focused, she had a lot of ability, and she knew exactly where she was going as a student. And it's wonderful to have that record. Now, I mean, any major exhibition of Julie's retrospective that there will need this work, and it's fantastic that it's in the Curtin University collection. The other project which we were really happy with in the School of Artists, we started the first associate degree in Aboriginal art in any university in the country. And we had some wonderful students, absolutely fantastic students. At one stage, I think there were as many as 30 students enrolled in this course, which was joint between the School of Art and the Centre for Indigenous Studies. Is that what it's called now? The Centre for Aboriginal Studies. And these were works that were done by Laurel Nanup, talking or describing her early life, the stories, the big black car that was the terrifying car which came to take the young kids away, particularly those who were, looked a little whiter than their relatives. It was such a powerful series of works, and again, it was brought from the degree show. And I thought it just had to be in this exhibition because, one, it documents that very important period when we did have an associate degree in Aboriginal art, and they are really remarkable works. And for anybody who knows Laurel, and she was here at the opening, which was so wonderful, Laurel was the person in that course really who made it happen, because a lot of the kids had not been in a university before and they found it really quite threatening. And then there was Laurel. There was sort of Auntie Laurel. So everybody went to Laurel and sat down and had a chat with her and felt a lot better and continued on for a little bit longer. I think without her, she was the glue which held that entire course together, and everybody was just so happy celebrating when she finally graduated and also produced this wonderful body of work. And of course, as you know, has gone on to do other wonderful things as well. Okay, George Edgerton Warburton. George was this crazy guy. Still is. He still is. But he was a crazy student. And he kept turning up and doing weird things, like making clothes for himself and getting a bike ready and riding from here to, where was his farm? Somewhere in the wheat belt.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was a long, it was like, you know, 150, 200 kilometres or something. And it had a trolley or trailer at the back. And every time he passed a piece of roadkill, he would pick up this whatever and dump it in the back and then skin it and tan the hide and then turn it into this coat, which he then presented as a performance with the car and the trolley and the quite rank smelling, actually not too well tanned, jacket that he'd made. So he was just one of those students that you immediately love and think, this is exactly what art school is for, and good heavens, what would George have done without the art school, and what would the art school have done without George? And so for his degree show, he did a couple of paintings of a meth lab. Of course. I don't think anybody asked too deeply whether it was his meth lab or just one that he happened to pass. Or
it was advertised. So a woman actually advertised it as a potential meth lab for people to use.
Oh, really? Oh, good on you, Leah.
I think on the internet. Yeah. Is that right, Susan?
Yeah, it was something on
that.
I always thought that might just be
the story. Yes, well, as with George, there's lots and lots of stories.
Chicken in it, which is very revealing.
That's right, George did. And he did this amazing event for the New Wave Festival called the Chicken Run, where he was going to release, how many, 10,000 chickens or something?
Chickens.
A lot of chickens. And eventually the RSPCA intervened. Anyway, so that we have this great picture, and there's two of them, in fact, by George from his degree show, is also, I think, a wonderful moment in time. And of course, as with Christian, his work has gone on to be very, very different. But we actually have one of these sort of key germinal works from this young artist developing. Kathy Blanchflower's work at the end is another example of, I mean, Kathy is now highly regarded abstract artist. She's Brian Blanchflower's daughter, as you probably know. She continues to make wonderful pictures. And this was one of the works that was, again, in her degree show. So you can see that from a very early age, she had developed pretty much a focus on where she wanted to go. And she was developing that with a really, you know, incredible confidence and skill for a young student. this is a work I think that is important in the collection because there will be a major retrospective or a survey show of Kathy's work, and they will need this work. So it's great that it will come from the institution that, in fact, nurtured her in her early years as a student. The two pictures on the end there were also very important to include. I don't know what you think. Would you? Are you anybody surprised that those works are there, or you think, what are they? A bit odd. No? Oh, you're so generous. My wife thought they looked pretty crappy and wondered what the hell they were doing. But the reason they're there is a bit like the Laurel Nanups. We had, Curtin began to be very interested in getting international students, and anybody who's still here will understand where that led. But the art school always had a bit of difficulty in getting students. It was a very expensive exercise, and for a lot of parents, they wanted their kids to come and do business or get a profession. So coming to do art didn't seem like, you know, it was perhaps the great use of a lot of money. But Chandrasekaran and Sally Japa were our two first international students who came from Singapore. And again, a bit like George, they were a whirlwind. They were so full of energy, full of life. They had a different perspective on the world. And they encouraged everybody to see the world differently. They actually gave us all, I think, a very different perspective on just everyday things. It was amazing that they would... do you remember them?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Chandra,
yeah. I mean, Chandra... One of my memories of Chandra actually was of sort of the terror of having to go to the ethics committee and explain why he wanted to use buckets of blood to soak himself and then drag himself through the streets of Perth. Well, that's perfectly reasonable. But of course, coming from his culture, his Hindu culture, and the ritual associated with certain celebrations throughout the year, it was in fact very, very logical. But we did have to argue it through the ethics committee, and I have to say, congratulations to Curtin's ethics committee because they passed it, and he was able to do that major project. But it was important for me anyway, thinking about how we collect work, that we at least collected some work from Chandra and Saleh. They both had an exhibition at Pika, in fact, when they graduated. So I'm surprised we didn't buy other things or even bigger things, but there you go. And that's, again, looking back, you think, you know, I was so pleased we bought that Anna Habick over there, because Anna is just such an amazing person. And she came to Curtin from UWA, where she'd done her PhD in anthropology. I said to her, "Well, sort of, what concessions do you want? You probably don't want to do art history." "Oh, I want to do everything." She attended every class. She was the most unusual student I've ever come across. She attended every class. She handed in every essay on time. She put just total energy into the course. And she really transformed herself into a really fantastic painter. I don't think she does much anymore. You probably know that she's just written a major book about Aboriginal performance. She's written very, very important books about the Stolen Generation. She is an amazing academic. She's still here at Curtin. But it's also great that she did decide at that point in her life that she wanted to take on this creative exercise. And she went through and did her BA and then her MA in the School of Art, which was fantastic. I guess while we're looking at that wall, which is beautifully grey, I must say, there's always a reason to put things together. Sometimes it's thematic, whatever, and sometimes it's really just because they look great together. And those three works, I think, look fantastic together. Gina Moore was a student who always, I thought, had the most beautiful touch as a painter. Her father was an architect, and she had started getting interested in making artworks by doing drawings for his firm so that he would do his architectural designs, and she would translate those architectural designs into these absolutely fantastic pencil drawings and gouaches. And then when she came to Curtin, she really took off as a painter. And I think some of those pictures, particularly the very subtle tonality, the sense of place, the sense of drama, that she was able to even capture it with very, very simple means, but with such a depth skill. She was one of the great draftspeople that I've ever come across. It was just wonderful. And so although that was not bought from her degree show, she did do some great things in her degree show. In fact, we have one of her things at home from her degree show. But that was bought a little bit later, but I just thought it was really important to put someone like Gina in. She now doesn't do any painting, but she does do lots of animation. She's become a really fantastic animator. So people move on, find new areas of development. Hopefully one day she'll go back to painting. One person who's never given up painting is Tom Alberts. The wonderful Tom Alberts, in fact, he's just gone off to, I think it's to, is it France or England? Where's he gone? He's just gone somewhere. I contacted all of these people to tell them that they were in the exhibition. So it was really nice to make contact again. And Tom was just on a plane off to do another residency somewhere, and that's a painting called The Senseless Young Man. Again, it's not one of the ones from Tom's degree show. There are a couple in the collection, but I chose that one because I do think in many ways it encapsulates a lot of the way that Tom has developed his practice. There's an area, a level of fantasy, but it's always absolutely rooted in his sense of being a realist painter and his fantastically developed skill. Now, Tom at the moment is also developing off in another direction, film noir. And if you look at that picture, you'd think, ah, I wonder where that came from. But he's making this very long film about the Melbourne art scene, which includes cameos from just about every important artist in Melbourne in this wonderful film noir detective story. Okay, so the other works in this part of the room, the books. So Tom Mueller, when he was a student, did this great project called The World Passport, and he set himself up in a booth, and we could go along and you could register for a world passport, and that gave you permission to be able to travel around the world. It was one of those, it's like the Esperanto of travel. It made everybody equal. It was all about a new world in which we could all share experiences and travel freely and not be constrained. And it was just such a wonderful utopian vision. And there was Tom in his beautiful little suit and tie, sitting behind a desk, looking like the handsome sort of Aryan, you know, god that he is, and signing people up to this world passport. It was fantastic. So there was another work of Tom's that I would love to have included, which was from his degree show, which was to do with ley lines, and it was made out of copper, and it had electricity, and it was probably going to kill somebody. So unfortunately, we decided that we'd keep the utopian vision going rather than the dystopian, and we didn't include that. But fortunately, we had this one, so we could include that as well. Holly Story, who's a wonderful West Australian artist, and made this book as part of her master's, I think it was, wasn't it? Was it her master's? I think it was her master's. But it was part of... one of the things that I really love about the School of Art is that it embraces so many different areas of practice, and the crafts have always been very, very strong. It's one of the things we tried to do in the gallery also, to provide a focus on the crafts as much as the obvious sort of painting, sculpture, video, but also to really showcase and highlight the wonderful craft practices that are undertaken by West Australian artists. And so Holly is a wonderful textiles artist, and Helen Britton is an artist who came to us to do her master's, and was one of those really demanding, challenging students that you just love, because she was determined that this was going to be something that was really important in her life. It wasn't going to be just turning up occasionally and knocking out a few things and getting a piece of paper and going off again. This, she had put her energy and her time and her commitment into this, and this was going to be fantastic, and you are going to help me make it fantastic. So she decided she was going to go to Europe. She wanted to travel as a part of it, so we managed to get her this sort of scholarship. She travelled around. She was able to do a part of it in Rotterdam in Holland, part of her course. She came back, and she produced this really remarkable... That's a book that she made, one of her incredible notebooks, which she continues to make, I may say. And she made this incredible body of work for her degree show. And fortunately, we bought, I think there's eight or so items from that exhibition, which is a really fantastic record of an artist who is now one of the leading international contemporary jewelers in the world. That is absolutely honest, no qualification needed. She is included in all the major collections. She has exhibitions all throughout Europe and America and the UK. She is clearly one of the great stars of contemporary jewellery. And she started it at Curtin and really pushed the jewellery school or the jewellery department into new directions. I mean, she could have continued on in the very, very excellent traditions that the jewellery department and three-dimensional design department had established, but no, Helen wanted to push, always to push, and to find new ways of doing things. So this was a body of work that she produced. Kalia Makigawa, I'm wearing Kalia Makigawa today as well. Kalia was also one of the really fantastic students from the jewellery metalwork department. It really was and continues to be one of the major areas of practice within Curtin University School of Art. It's extraordinary that they were, in fact, able to do so much and to get so much international recognition. So many of those artists have gone on to do really quite phenomenal things. So it's great to have Kalia in the show and Sarah Elson as well. Sarah's beautiful series of little flower things. She started casting from found objects, and she had for her degree show, I think it's quite a lot of those, weren't there?
I can't remember the number, but it was.
But there was a lot.
A lot.
Yeah.
We've got
Yeah.
But there were a lot.
But it was the most beautiful, stunning installation. It was just remarkable and really showed how she had developed her skills and her practice. So it was just wonderful that when I was thinking about it, we had to include some of the crafts, had to include jewellery, and had to include textiles. So here we have the wonderful Nal de Searles. How am I going for time?
Good.
Another 5 minutes or so?
It's only 1 o'clock, so.
Oh.
Yeah. We've got 2:30, haven't we? Yes, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Nalda was another one of those remarkable students that came, a mature age student. She came and again insisted that she wanted no exemptions. She wanted to do the entire course from first year all the way through. She, again, like Anna Habick, put all her energy into it. She was really just fantastic. And being Nalda, she immediately made friends of everybody in the place, and everybody very soon sort of started treating her as a point of reference, a go-to person, not necessarily for artistic matters, though of course she was very talented and skilled craftsperson, but also just for matters about life. She was really, and still is, a most remarkable and wonderful person.
What year was that?
Oh, early on, it would have been
I think this was
96. I was going to say 95, so yeah. About 96? Yeah. I could look that up, couldn't we? Yeah. but Nalda, after doing everything, so she wanted to try everything, she didn't want to just remain a craftsperson, but as a craftsperson, she gradually started to use all of those skills that she'd learned in other media and to focus them back into her practice as a maker and as a textile worker. And this was also at the period when she was working with Padjiti Mary MacLean, and she was working alongside Mary, and they were doing some stuff. We had a wonderful exhibition in this gallery where we had Mary, I think she was actually in this space. It was this space, wasn't it? So Mary would come every afternoon, was much too cold, every morning was much too cold for her, but she got all rugged up and she would just sit on the floor and draw. And as people came in, particularly kids, she'd give them a pencil and get them to help draw with her. She even had the Vice Chancellor, Lance Toomey, drawing with her on one occasion. So it was the most inspiring thing to see this wonderful artist just there and making work. And she made some fantastic works, and they are also in the collection. And again, I was thinking of incorporating those, but Mary wasn't a student here, so So why am I talking about Mary? So, Nalda.
It was important to Nalda.
And so Nalda made this wonderful blanket, and it's about a community. It's about women getting together and talking and engaging and explaining and discussing and becoming part of a larger community. I think it was announced at the opening that there was only one work in the whole collection that all three curators fought over. And I said, there is no way that this is not going in my part. I think probably John and Chris said the same thing. But because I was the first in...
You were the first.
I got my list in first. I bagged it. And I'm really pleased that it's in the collection. And I'm really pleased it's in front of this work too by Kevin Draper. Because Kevin, we're talking about some of the courses that were started. So there was the associate degree in Aboriginal art. But we also had it for a while, a course that was run down in Albany. And there was a group of students who came up from Albany from their associate degree in Albany to do their final year up in Perth. And boy, were they an extraordinary group. There were about six of them. Angela Stewart, Kevin Draper, John Grew,
Bruce Slatter.
Just a most amazing group of people, really. And if you think of you grabbing a group of students and just from a year, and just think this was this one group that came from Albany. They were really...
Most of them still practicing. Unusual.
Yeah. Who did that wonderful... It's gone now, that sculpture for Sculpture by the Sea of the sign, you know, the arrows going around. Anyway, she was part of the group as well. Fantastic artist.
Coral.
So this is a work that Kevin was, like all those people, they came with, in fact, like all art students, they come with a myriad of skills. And Kevin had all this incredible skill at working with metal. And so this was just such a fantastic work, again, from his degree show, that just shows his interest. And now, again, if you look at the work that Kevin continues to make, you can see the roots of it, in this particular work. It sort of almost embodies so much of his practice. The works on the back there are by Sue Baker, and I included those because we began to give postgraduate students the opportunity to show their work in the John Curtin Gallery as a part of their final preparation for their degree show, or this was their exhibition that was assessed by visiting examiners. It hadn't been something that the university had done. It was always felt previously that there should be a separation, that the exhibition program really should be for artists who had left art school rather than those who were still here. But we made the case very strongly that these were people who already had a practice and who were coming back to get their PhDs or their masters, and they were practicing artists, and it was appropriate for them to show their work in the context of the gallery. And we also worked on the idea that, in fact, showing in a gallery is really an important part of your developing professional practice. Knowing how to deal with curators, how to deal with in-store staff, what you can get out of the experience of installing your work in a gallery, with, you know, professional lighting, with all of the things that go together in putting an exhibition to really showcase your work. And so that was really part of the project, that that people came and installed their work and learnt about the process of working with curators and professional art museum people, working on the catalogue, working on publicity and marketing, working on all those different areas. So Sue was one of the first of the PhD students who had an exhibition. It was in these two spaces. I remember it very well. And it was a terrific exhibition. And for that, she began to play into experiment with digital printing. Which, of course, is now so ubiquitous, but at that point was actually very new. And so these are very early digital prints. And in fact, when I told Sue that they were up, she went, "Oh my God, what do they look like? Have they faded? Are they still okay?" I said, "Actually, they look terrific. They really do look terrific." So basically, that was my selection, and it was the reason I put them together, as I explained, was I really wanted to see, for myself, to go back and see what decisions we'd made that were the really good ones, where we had where there were oversight, and there were a few oversights, and I noted some of them down. We didn't collect Abdul Abdullah, for instance, when during his degree show, or Nathan Beard, or James Angus. Now, I mean, you know, James is like an international superstar, and yet we didn't buy his work.
I bought a work of his from the degree show.
Did you?
Yeah.
Talking of actually death traps, one of them was a death trap, as I remember.
The
live wire, electrical wire. That's probably why. But Purdy Phillips we didn't buy, and also Matthew Nui. Now, Matthew is such an important figure, and I can't actually remember why we didn't buy Matthew's work, but there must have been a good reason at the time, but looking back, it's clearly a gap. But of course, as you can see, we did make some very good decisions, and it's great to have these works as part of the collection, and to celebrate the fact that there is an art school in this university, and that this now becomes a wonderful archive for that. So, I was going to mention Joshua Webb's work, because that was one work that I had from the very beginning. I thought, I really want to include this work, because I remember it as being, it was a part of his postgraduate work, and it was a very large work. I could sort of explain it. It looked like a sort of a cairn of rocks with a flag out the top of it, and a huge bank of fans, of just sort of domestic fans, circular fans, that blew against it and made the flag wave. And it was called The Liberation of a Bored Monk. And it seemed to me to be just such a perfect image of the industrial military machine, that it requires all of this energy to keep this flag flying, and yet basically what we need is peace. But in fact, it's just this massive weight of energy and power and money that has to go to produce war. So, and I love that work. Sadly, it needs to be totally rewired, so we couldn't include it. But again, I think that was a really bold and brave and important acquisition for the university to make. So, I was reading through a document the other day, and I came across this wonderful statement about what university art museums should be. I quoted it in the catalogue, but I'll quote it again now just to end, because it comes from a philosopher, he's a Catholic philosopher, in fact, Cyril Barrett, and he said that university-based art collections have a very important role. They provide edification, stimulation, irritation, and aesthetic satisfaction, and I hope really all of these works do, if not all of those together, at least enough of those to sum up to really fulfil Barrett's definition of what a university art collection should do. Thank you.
Thank you. That was fantastic.
Pleasure.
I'm so many to use when I have to do some tours. Does anybody have any questions? You're quiet during the talk because I think it was so comprehensive, but does anyone want to ask Ted anything before we go through for a cup of tea? Huh? Wow, this is
the best. Is the thing in Warburton?
Yes.
It's possible, in the way I think about it, it might be a pun, because it seems as if with whatever he used, whether I suppose it's oil, is it?
Yeah.
He used an enormous amount of meths. Because it's a wash in some way that's still from being oil into...
It's terps, though, yeah.
Terps.
I think it's a meth lab.
He had another work which went alongside that work, which is called Myth Lab.
Yeah.
And that was a bit more abstract.
Yeah.
So he created three works. We now have all three because the library bought one, but
we've taken
over their collection. So we have all three now.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah, he's a really interesting character. George, keep an eye out.
You didn't mention Claire.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, I just realised there are two of her works there.
Yes, Claire McFarlane.
Represent her.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Rodney. Well, Claire is a wonderful painter. Again, part of the... she was an undergraduate and then a postgraduate student at Curtin. And she's done work using pattern, particularly William Morris prints, and combining them with either flowers or birds or insects. And these are just two from a series that she did, which was part of her master's project. And again, I think it's great that there are really good quality examples of her work in the university collection, because she's terrific. And actually, she works with us at the moment at the Lawrence Wilson Art Gallery. So it's nice to have all those connections too.
Ted, one of the things that was really lovely to hear was your conversation about the Sue Baker work and that being part of her PhD exam up here. And I think that really did pave the way for a whole lot more of those sorts of examinations at this space. I mean, we've been through times where there were masters up here, and occasionally we have honours, I think, up here sometimes.
Yes,
but the next show after this, actually, interestingly, is four of our about-to-be-examined PhDs.
Oh, that's
so
great.
I think it's really lovely to see that work appears on the wall in a show that's a prelude to the one that's going to be in the students, 12, 15 years later, be examined in this space again.
Yeah.
Which students?
In fact, two of them were just sneaking off as I came in and saying, we've got to go and do some work. Lely Raksha, who's printmaking and drawing. Alana McVay, ceramics, beautiful porcelain ceramics. Marty Crocker, very small, beautiful detailed paintings. And Kelsey Gambazzi, large format textile work.
Oh, great.
And then we've got two others who have been examined off campus who will have just a small showcase of works as well.
That's great.
Making and drawing on. So, it'll be really nice to fill the space again.
Yeah. I think as we know, if you're an artist, your aspiration is always to show in a public gallery. And therefore, when you graduate, you actually have that opportunity and you get to learn the skills, because it's not just an easy task. You actually do. It's about negotiation. It's about understanding, you know, that you can't put your big noisy video on next to somebody's quiet ceramics, because that ain't going to work. So it's about negotiation, and it's about understanding, and it's about actually using the space the best way you can to present your work. So I think it was a great opportunity for grasped by those people as well, certainly by Sue and others. Yeah.
We sort of rebadged it, didn't we, last year so it's now a degrees, 18 or 17, whatever.
Right. Good.
Yeah, I think it's a really nice, tight show. I'm trying to remember what date we opened, but
26th of July.
That's right.
I remember that.
I don't remember that. Because I'm trying to harness all the energy to get them ready for it.
Absolutely.
Hard work. And anyway, that will be a really good show.
Ted, Akio Makagawa was a student here. Also.
Yes, he was.
Is he in the collection?
We have a major work that was part of his graduate exhibition, which was on show last year as part of 50-50, which is a really large weight-balanced work, and it actually had been out on campus for many, many years. But it's an incredible work.
It's beautiful work,
created by a student is just phenomenal. Yep. So we have some other works of his.
There's some sale works too.
Sale works, and we had a new one came in a couple of years ago from a private donor. Yeah, so we do have a few.
Okay. And this is a tiny fraction, isn't it, the whole
collection? Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean,
there's around 3,000 works in the collection.
Yeah. And of the contemporary Australian, there are 484. So the works that are by people who are linked to the university are roughly a third of that, which is great.
Thinking of putting their entire collection
on the walls.
Having one exhibition where they put everything up.
What a terrible idea. Anyway.
Ted, when you were putting it together, did you have a sort of linking idea or conversation that binds all the works together, or is it just purely?
Well, the link was that they are all graduate students. Yeah. I tried to find works that were bought from the degree show, wherever possible. And then really the hang was how to put those works together. So there wasn't a specific link about this work over that work. In most cases it was, well, if we have those two works that are like banners, like unstretched, we probably need something in the middle that will hold them together. And so there were decisions like that really, but they were more not aesthetic but structural. For the way the exhibition went together. But no, the basic premise was that this would be about how the university has collected work of their graduates, and what are some of the pitfalls that we hadn't collected some people, And what are some of the fantastic joys that we did in fact collect early works of artists who've now gone on to be really well known and highly regarded.
I think it's really nice that the three of you had actually very distinct methodologies and curatorial framework, which is really important because it is such a vast collection. You need to start somewhere.
Yep.
And for each, you know, selection to be quite personal and, you know, your own interests and involvement with the collection. I think each of the work really each of the spaces demonstrates that really well.
Mm. Everyone wants to find out more from, particularly from the other two curators, who what their premise is in the catalogue. Each of the curators has contributed their curatorial statement to the catalogue, so you can always find out more. Thank you so much, Ted.
Pleasure.
And
thank you all.